and welcome to The Academinist, the podcast about equality and feminism in STEM.
We're your hosts, Jodie
and Rebecca, two neuroscientists in London
who just happen to be women.
Join us as we discuss how inequality affects women and minorities in science today and what we can all do to fix this. Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Academinist, the podcast about equality and feminism in STEM. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Rebecca.
And I'm Jodie. That always seems like the scariest part, you know.
Oh, why?
It's like, I don't know. It's like I'm going to forget my name. Right. I don't know. I just always think, your name's Jodie, your name's Jodie, your name's Jodie. Once we've done it, I think, oh, thank God that bit's over.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if you came out with something rogue, I'd probably just I wouldn't question it. I'd just be like, oh well, that's just who she wants to be known as now. So yeah, so as usual, it feels like the month has gone by way too quick for me. It's a bit weird now because I basically just work at home all the time, well, most of the time. Like, I sneak into the lab occasionally to, well, mainly just take care of my fruit fly farm, but that's it.
Did really. You see the present I left you?
I did, yeah.
In the window.
Yeah, get you co-workers who leave you little plant cuttings, and it's super pretty. Like, I've been eyeing up some of the plants on Jodie's desk for a while now, and then I come in and I've got a little cutting in a falcon. So yeah, that's always, it's very nice.
And it's got a little baby leaf on it. Like, when I cut it off, I must admit, I was a little bit gutted because I saw the little cute baby leaf got like a really distinct pattern on it. So yeah, I'm excited to see that turn into a big leaf. So I feel like we're co-parents of it. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it can come to you at weekends. It's fine.
Every other weekend. I've got a life.
All right. Okay. We're a bit plant obsessed in our office. We quite often have like cute little plant exchanges going on. So Get yourself colleagues like that. It's very wholesome.
It is wholesome, but the way I described it to someone the other day was that surrounding myself by things that are alive makes me feel a little bit less dead inside.
I think that was me you were talking
about. Was it you?
Because you said, so I came into the office and I clocked that Jodie'd got a nice new collection of plants growing on her shelf. And I commented on this, and I think the words you said were, oh, these are the ones that aren't doing so well at home. I bring them in because for some reason they grow here and it makes me feel that at least something can thrive in academia. Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
Yeah, that does sound like me, to be fair. Yeah. I do wonder if that's why everyone on our floor likes them. It's like, you can nurture something.
Yeah. And also, like, if we build up enough foliage, then that's also a great place to hide from PIs when they're around, you know?
Yeah. That's why I haven't seen you in so long.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you just got to cultivate a little micro environment.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, who could blame anyone for wanting to do that? Because as we've discussed last episode, PhDing is quite hard at the moment around the world, but we know best kind of the context in the UK, where we're having a lovely old cost of living crisis. And last month we spoke to Sophie Langdon, who is a fellow PhD at King's College London, and just chatted about experiences of financial stress meeting general PhD stress. And it was so lovely to hear from so many people who really found that the episode resonated with them and made them feel less alone. So yeah, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone who kind of engaged with that and shared their thoughts and experiences on social media. It's always lovely. I mean, obviously the stuff wasn't lovely, but it was lovely to hear from people.
Yeah,
it was nice to hear that some people found it helpful.
Yeah, and it wasn't just PhD students either. There was people of all levels that were sort of getting involved with the conversation. I mean, it was a very good like time for us to release that episode, right? Because I feel like it just fit in well with all the conversations that are going on. And obviously one of the like measurable actions at the end of the episode that we've included in our show notes and hopefully pointed some people towards was the open letter to the UKRI. And as of the 5th of July, so a little while ago now, so I'll have to recheck.
It's the most up to date on the petition itself.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So as of the 5th of July, that letter hit 10,000 signatures. So, I mean, that's amazing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think PhD students have for too long accepted that this is just the way it is. So it's so great to see action and people sort of saying this is not good enough. Mm. It was also actually covered in some mainstream press here in the UK. And as far as I know so far, the UKRI have acknowledged the open letter and said that they're considering additional financial support, but I don't know if there's been any tangible outcome yet, but it's still relatively early days.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess watch this space and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and I think like obviously the engagement in the conversation has been really positive, but there's still some like pushback and people still not quite understanding the gravity of the situation and the pressure on PhD students. So actually just this week, I think it was the University of East Anglia, right? Yeah. So they basically sent an email out to PhD students to say, we understand that, you know, the cost of living's increased and this is difficult. Okay, great. But their solution was not, we're going to try our best to try and find you some extra funding, or we're going to send letters to government, or any of these kind of actual helpful actions. Their suggestion was actually for PhD students to take on extra work as Avon salespersons. So, I mean, that's a very interesting take.
It's really interesting. So, yeah, it was like a DTP that was funded ultimately by the UKRI, like a sub body of that specific to like a certain field within research. It was an email that went round with like a little list of things that you can take on as side jobs, and yeah, like selling Avon products was there. I just can't imagine the brainstorming session that went into that list.
Yeah, I know. And I think also you need to think like certain universities have really strict rules about how much work you're allowed to do outside of your PhD. So it just doesn't really add up, and it's not always in the student's control. So it just doesn't really make the playing field very even in terms of student having equal opportunities to be able to make enough money to live. So it's just not really a solution.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it comes down to as well, PhD researchers are classed as students, which creates a lot of opportunities to exploit us when we're doing essentially full-time work. And institutions fully acknowledge and are fully aware of how difficult a PhD is, because they limit how much extra work you can take on. And then it's like, well, if you're not going to pay PhD students enough to actually not have to resort to that, you need to remove those limits. And yeah, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Although there's still a little bit of pushback and there's obviously a lot of work to do, as always, there has also been some good outcomes so far. So at King's College London, on the MRCTTP, which is what we're on, they've actually sent an email today. So this is really good timing for recording this little bit. So they actually sent an email today announcing a one-off £1,000 payment, so like a relief payment, to a certain set of students, depending on what date they started on the DTP. So, you know, there are some things. So this, you know, there are some positive movements, but a one-off payment is not enough to fix the sort of like long-term increases in rent and bills and, you know, just living. So, I mean, it's a great step, but it's like, it's not enough.
I think it is also really interesting, or it will be interesting to see now that this precedent has been set, what other UKRI funded doctoral training programs are going to do. Now this example has been set, it's kind of like, yeah, we're looking at you. Like, are you gonna step up and do the same thing? What I would take away from this is that if you stick together and you push back, things will happen, and you have to just keep pat it. So keep writing your letters.
Yeah.
Keep signing your letters. Don't let them think that it's gone away. Also, like what you said, on like an individual level, if you can, it's really great to ask for help. So for example, which Jodie mentioned earlier, that Sophie ended up actually having a conversation with her PI about some of the things that she mentioned on the podcast,
yeah,
which was really great. I also have the same thing. So I have two supervisors, and I sort of told one of them that stuff was like really difficult at the moment because of, you know, the sort of chronically low stipend that I'm on. And actually, whilst also trying to figure out my funding for like my PhD extension, they, and I didn't have to ask them to do this, they just topped up my stipend by £200 a month, which was yeah, can't really like emphasize enough how helpful that was. So
yeah,
I think like on an individual level, if you can, and obviously not everyone has a great relationship with their PI, and if you're in a small lab, there isn't always the money for them on an individual basis to make adjustments, but it definitely helps if you can to have conversations and just ask for help if you can at that level, as well as sort of the big systemic change. I think it's like another avenue you can go down if you're immediate, if like if you're struggling. And
absolutely,
yeah, yeah, there's, yeah,
and I think that not just in terms of financial help as well. So like this is another example as well that's happened to me in the last like month. I felt that I needed additional support in terms of supervision, and so I was able to go through avenues to get that sorted, and I was sent an official communication about it today. But I've now got a third supervisor that's been added onto my project, because I felt like I was missing a stream of expertise, and that I would benefit from having this additional like point of call and this additional person to support me through the remainder of my PhD. And that's something that's been put in place for me, and it wouldn't have been if I hadn't have asked for it. So yeah, I guess the message from this is, whether it's financial support, emotional support, educational support, whatever it is that you need, just ask for it, and the worst that you can be told is no. And I feel really sad for people that don't let on that they're struggling and don't ask for that support in fear of like being told no, it's not available, we can't help you. Because in this case, if I hadn't reached out and asked for this to be put in place, I'd still be in the position I was like a month ago, where I was really overwhelmed. And this has been a really positive change. I'm really now hopeful for like the remainder of my PhD being that little bit better.
Yeah, ah, I love that for you. go us, we've been so great at like being proactive and asking for help. Like,
I know, and sticking to our guns.
Yeah, so yeah, we've followed our own advice. Oh my god.
When does that happen?
Yeah, no, but like absolutely, like there is no reason why you should buy into kind of the idea that's really prevalent in academia, that oh, it's always been that way, or it was hard for me, that's just the way it is, so like why should it be any different for you? Like, just don't, like that all needs to go in the bin. And the only way we put it in the bin is if we start doing exactly what we've done and asking for what we actually deserve in terms of help and support.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, go us. What a great month. But yeah, so a lot had happened since we released that episode. So yeah, we just wanted to update you on various bits and pieces that we've seen coming out in terms of news. So yeah, this month we were talking to Mal Ahmed, who is a psychology PhD student at Goldsmiths. And she also shared her perspective on being self-funded as a PhD student. And just to clarify, I mean, Mal does clarify in the episode, but this is self-funded, not in the sense of she just has an excess of savings and her own money to just pay for a PhD out of her own pocket. She's self-funded in the sense that she's struggling to make ends meet because her funding comes from a government postgraduate research loan that she applied for, and then also working on the side. So it was really interesting to hear her perspective of that, because honestly, it sounds pretty tough, and I'm sure there are other people going through the same thing. But apart from that, we were also talking to Mal about religion in research, because she is a practicing Muslim as well as a researcher. So yeah, it was really interesting talking about how these things all intersect. Yeah, I don't know about you, I learned a lot.
Yeah, I did. It was quite interesting to have a conversation around that, and how for someone who is a proud religious person, and also a proud scientist, and how those two things can coexist. So yeah, it was a really interesting conversation, and I think actually you've probably done a fantastic job editing it down because we were chatting for ages. I was actually recording it from the lab, I think.
It was a chaotic start. Me and Mal were just having a catch up while we were waiting for Jodie, who was just running around the lab with her laptop. Like,
oh, I'm so sorry. I had a plate in my hand because I had to go to three different plate readers until one worked, and then I ended up being late, and then I couldn't find a spot where I could go with my laptop, so I settled for in the cold lab. I actually put my lab coat on for warmth at one point. And so I think we could have chatted for a lot longer, but essentially I was going to be kicked out of the building. So
yeah.
Don't take our word for it. Have a listen for yourself.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Academinist. We've got off to a slightly chaotic start, but we are super excited to be joined by Mal Ahmed, who is going to be chatting to us about religion and research, amongst lots of other things. Mal, hi, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me. Very exciting.
We wanted to get you on for a while because, if anyone listening doesn't know, me and Jodie went and chatted on Mal's podcast, Honest Academia, and we had a great time, and we've been really wanting to get you back to come and chat to us for ages, so it's really exciting to have you. Let's jump in and start. So for anyone who's listened to the show for a long time, you'll know that this is always a bit we do at the beginning, where we like to hand the mic over and let our guests introduce themselves with their unapologetic introduction, and emphasis on unapologetic. So the reason we do this is because a lot of the time, women and minorities in STEM, we're kind of taught to underplay our achievements. So this is an opportunity to really introduce yourself without downplaying any of the good stuff, like awards. It doesn't even have to be like massive stuff like awards or achievements. It can just be stuff that you're really proud of. But yeah, would you like to tell us and our audience a bit about you and introduce yourself?
Okay, so I am Maliat. I am a 25-year-old PhD student in her second year at the moment, hopefully moving on to her third year, inshallah, fingers crossed. And I am studying empathy, and I'm looking at women and how our menstrual cycles affect empathic abilities and like all things surrounding empathy, things like emotion regulations and stuff like that. I'm also an associate lecturer, which I think is quite cool for someone who's so young, because it's weird to be in a classroom full of kids who are like, what, 19, and I'm only 25. So, and it's nice to like help the younger academics move on in their career. Other than that, I also dabble in social science communication. So I have an Instagram called PhD Pending, which has a cute little family, and I talk to other PhD students about their experiences, as well as just sort of share my experiences as a Muslim in academia and self-funded. So I fit into these variety of small brackets where it shouldn't be possible for me to be here, and I won't lie, it's tough, but I am.
I love that. I mean, that all sounds amazing and super impressive, especially that you're an associate lecturer before you've even finished your PhD. Like, you're going to get us here in our imposter syndrome.
It's basically a job that's for PhD students here at Goldsmiths. So they basically get you to teach seminars, and well, we call them tutorials. So it sounds way fancier and I sound very accomplished, but really...
Mal, you didn't hear the unapologetic part of the introduction. You're qualifying now. You're undoing the unapologetic part. Own it.
Cut out what I just...
No, we're gonna keep it in. I'm gonna make an example.
You're gonna scare off our future guests. They're gonna listen to that and just be like, oh god. So you mentioned actually a little bit in your introduction, and I love that you said you shouldn't be here but you are. You shared a bit about how you're self-funding your PhD. Do you want to share a bit about how that's been for you? Because last month we actually spoke to another PhD student about how doing a PhD intersects with like financial privilege and also the cost of living crisis at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it would just be great to hear your side as well, as another perspective of how it's affecting PhD students and how that's going, because self-funding must be incredibly tough.
Yes. So it is tough. I think the important distinction to make for me versus other self-funded students that might exist is that I'm not self-funded in terms of like I have money so I can just pay for a degree. I'm getting a government loan. So we have a doctoral loan in the UK, which I don't think was available all the time, but it was available when I started. So I took that. And I feel like I was definitely told that it would be tough if I do it this way. I was very much maybe a bit too headstrong. And I was like, I'm not going to let that stop me. What's another government loan going to do to me anyway? So I just went down that path. Essentially, you get around just under 9K a year. And your tuition's, for me anyway, is like roughly 4K. So it doesn't leave you a lot of room to survive. So for me, as a self-funded PhD student, I have to have a second job, which is where the associate lecturer job comes in. But even that, it doesn't really pay you a lot. So the fact that cost of living has gone up is just detrimental to me. Like, I have to figure out whether I need to get another part-time job on top of already having this job, on top of the PhD, which I also personally consider a job. It's a tough one, you know? Like, I feel... in the UK, academia is so inaccessible, and it's just like every single day, every single month, there's like a new thing to make a barrier for people who are like me. And there's no like sugarcoating it. I'm also Bengalis, right? So I'm a person of color, a minority. And most minorities don't come from a wealthier background. Obviously some do, but I come from the majority that doesn't. So on top of that, you have people who can't get into academia because of money. And then look at the pool of people that can't come in. It's minorities more often than not. So I chose the hard life and went for a loan. I don't know if I'd recommend it, to be honest. I'm fortunate enough that I can live at home. So if I wasn't able to live at home, this is not happening. There's no way. Sounds really sad, actually.
Thank you for sharing that. I think for people listening, it's important that people don't always understand the difference at undergrad, master's and PhD in terms of access to funds and what you need to be able to do those steps. Did you do a master's as well, Mal? Yeah. So in my kind of experience, the undergrad is, you know, you get student finance, which is more accessible than the master's and the PhD. You know, that's something that is pushed to you when you're at school, go into higher education. You don't have to pay back this loan. It's free money. You know, you can afford to go to uni. And so more people go in at that level. And then it's like, once you're in and you've got your sights set on a career in academia, you realize actually that you do need money past that stage. So like, for me, that was at the master's stage, because I'm on a funded PhD, I'm very lucky. But for the master's, it's same situation. I think the maximum loan was £10,000. And then once you had like accounted for the tuition fees for a master's, which in some universities like UCL, it's like 14K. So the maximum loan doesn't even cover the tuition. So you're automatically having to say no to certain very good universities because you're priced out of them. You know, that's difficult. And then you're left, like you said, with what's left to cover your rent, your food, your travel, all your living expenses, which, as we discussed last month, has all increased. And so then it pushes you in this place where you're told, I'm unstoppable, do whatever you want. And, you know, if you want something, you go and get it. But when the playing field is not level for everyone, it means that you're working maybe twice as hard or three times as hard as the people that are in your course. Like you just said, you've got a part-time job already to try and make ends meet. And now you're considering having a third job. And a PhD is a job. Yeah. It is, because you're full-time in a research environment. Me working as a research assistant and me working as a PhD student, there is no fundamental difference other than I get way less money in my pocket at the end of each month. So for anyone who hasn't embarked on a PhD, it is like having any other research job. job and it should be treated as such. And therefore, if you have to work alongside, that's something to obviously think about. So yeah, a lot of what you said makes sense to me, but I just wanted to put that into the context of those like different higher education brackets.
No, yeah, for sure. Like I was really fortunate for my master's because I went to Goldsmiths through and through. I was able to get a discount for my master's. So it was like significantly less. But even still, what frustrates me about this kind of stuff is that it doesn't even make sense because, you know, people love to hype academia. Oh, they've got a PhD, whatever, whatever. But why are you making it so difficult? You're like, look, we've given you loans to do a doctoral degree or a PhD, whatever. But the money you've given me, I meant to live and then do this full-time job. But you're this government who's trying to promote academic excellence. Like it's promoted to us within school, like from day dot when we're like young. It just really frustrates me because it's not adding up. As someone who I hope and I try to practice empathy, it doesn't make sense.
I think that's the problem. I think that's what our government don't have, Mal.
I mean, half of them have left now, no?
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with what you say, and especially about how on top of pushing people out who don't have financial privilege, that also affects mostly minorities and people of colour. And it's like, we literally talked about this last month as well, about how worrying it is the way this is selecting people out of academia. Mm. But yeah, thanks for sharing your experience on that so honestly as well. I think it's really important that people hear how other people are struggling as well, and it's not just them, because I think it can be quite isolating sometimes and you sort of think, oh, it's not that bad, I just need to get on with it. But it's actually a lot of people feel like this as well.
I think to add to that as well, just as a last little bit, this struggle that people have to go through deciding whether they need to get a second, third, I'm sure some people will have to get fourth jobs, is so strenuous on like your mental health as a PhD student as well. It's already tough. It's already like, take away the financial burdens of doing a PhD, the whole imposter syndrome thing. And, you know, you're always comparing yourself, even as much as everyone tells you not to, let's be honest, we are. And it's hard not to. Most of us share communal spaces. So we have friends who are doing the same things as us. Mm-hmm. And I'm not at the stage that I thought I would be at. And the fact that I'm paying for this and I'm not where I thought I would be at the end of my second year is devastating. It's like very demotivating. I don't know who's in charge or who can make the change to help PhD students, to help people in academia in general. If you want to help our mental health, a lot of this comes from our financial burdens, like lifting them, right?
Yeah.
100%.
So obviously we've talked about some of the challenges of being a PhD student in general, but also about your experiences of being a self-funded PhD. But I'd like to also talk about the things that you enjoy the most about what you do. So there's obviously a reason that you go into the PhD, and hopefully there's still elements of it that you enjoy because you're still there. So if you'd like to kind of balance that out and share a little bit of that, that'd be great.
Yeah, of course. So I wouldn't choose to go through this struggle for no reason, for shits and giggles. Am I allowed to say shits? Okay, cool. Thumbs up, yeah? For shits and giggles. I just love research as like standard as it is. Like the idea of, like just the concept of it, you know, like having a question and then trying to figure out the answer. It's just such a beautiful thing to me. And personally, I just think empathy is so important. And it's so underrated and not really understood. So combine the two together and it's just ideal. And obviously I'm a woman, so add the other one in. There we go. And in research, typically, unfortunately, like women as people aren't really considered as much. So that's the reason I'm here. I did start the PhD with the intention of doing brain stimulation as well. So that's another huge thing for me. I found out about it in my undergrad and I was just fascinated that we can manipulate how the brain is working, even temporarily, and do it safely. I felt like I could learn about like a brain and do it safely. It was just like everything for me. One thing that draws me to research is that I get to meet people with the kind of research that I want to do. I get to meet so many people during my master's and my undergrad. I met so many interesting people. I made connections. I made friends with some of the people that came to do my studies. And it's just, you meet people from all kinds of like walks of life, people who don't really know about psychology. They were just here for a quick tenor, but like they left being like, this is so cool. Like, I didn't realize this is what you can do. Or people who were maybe like just starting uni and they're like, oh, I didn't know that this is what you can do in psychology. Or I didn't know we could do this at this uni. And I was like, yes, you can. Like, it's just, yeah, I think it's the people part of it that makes me like obsessed with research.
I feel like those are all the right reasons as well.
Yeah. And that's what I said in my interview, didn't I? That's how I got here.
Nice. I'd hire you. Yeah.
No, it's so nice. And it's quite partly why we always ask about this on the podcast as well, like just seeing the way people light up when they're excited about what they do. It's so nice.
It is. It's nice to remember the good stuff.
Yeah, because we do chat about a lot of the not so good stuff here, and it's always nice to bring in the positives as well. So we've chatted to you before on your podcast, and through that conversation we ended up talking a bit about your experiences as a Muslim woman in STEM, and we were super interested and wanted to get you back to chat more about this because it's not something that we've really discussed on the podcast before, and we are all about including all of these various intersections and aspects of being a woman in STEM. So I guess just to start and to kind of bring our listeners up to speed as well, because they've just met you, do you want to share with us how your experiences working in science and practicing your religion have been for you, just generally, like, so the good and the bad, and whether others are supportive as well?
Yeah, so I'm a Muslim, proud Muslim, and my journey as a Muslim in academia is quite fluid. So I would say that I've become more religious during, like, say from my undergrad to here, and I think that's definitely, like, I can see the differences because a lot of academic circles revolve around pubs, I feel, at least in my experience, and I feel like I've become less comfortable with it. Not that I'm opposed to going there, like I'm gonna die if I walk through the door, but I would just prefer, maybe, if it doesn't have to be surrounded by alcohol. And I think even though I might be comfortable, I don't wear hijab, for example, so even if I was to be in a pub and you didn't know me, you might not necessarily assume that I am a Muslim, whereas I can imagine that maybe my counterparts who do wear hijab and they are Muslim in STEM, they won't feel comfortable in these settings. And these settings are really important for us as academics because this is where we network, this is where we make friends, this is when we bond with professors and people like above us, because they'll chit chat to us and they'll remember us for when we decide to apply for research assistant roles or even PhDs if you hadn't started your PhD yet. I didn't personally feel a type of way about it, but I know other people who, say, were to come with me, they didn't want to go inside, so I had to like change plans, say, and I was like, hey, cool, let me grab food, takeaway, and then we'll go sit somewhere else, because either they physically didn't feel comfortable to be in a pub, or B, just the attire that they were wearing, like if a hijabi Muslim or a Muslim man in like a thobe or something, they were worried would draw attention to themselves. So for me personally, it wasn't really an issue. I just only now find it a bit weird sometimes. Mm. Like, I would prefer not to, but if I have to, I'm not like dying. But that's just in me personally. As a Muslim in STEM, that's been pretty tough. In terms of practicing my religion, I've been quite fortunate, I think, to be in this university. And I feel like my experience as a practicing Muslim in academia might not be like appropriate for the wider representation, because I'm very comfortable with the department that I'm in, with the lab that I'm a part of, fortunately enough, that I will literally pull out my prayer mat in the middle of the office and just pray. Like, it doesn't bother me, and I don't feel uncomfortable. Even if, say, there's people doing meetings or talks, as long as I have space, my little mat, I'm good. Like, I have no problems with it. But I feel like maybe that might not be the case for other people, because I've stayed at this university. Whereas if I was to move to another institution, I can't say I would feel the same way, because I don't know these people. I don't know what their intentions are. With, like, not with me, but you know what I mean, like surrounding me. So.
Can I? Yeah. So the first thing that you talked about was the fact that a lot of networking in academia is centered around alcohol in a social context. Mm. That I'm going to be honest, that's something that I didn't think of. I thought, obviously, if you choose not to consume alcohol, I didn't think of the impact of the environment itself. So thank you for sharing that. And it made me think of quite well-known public engagement things like Pint of Science, which mm-hmm. is actually built around the fact that you have a pint while you present your research, and it's exclusively in bars and pubs. And that is unintentionally, I'm sure, excluding a section of academics and of researchers. So that's what came to mind when you shared that.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and thanks for sharing that, Mal. So continuing to talk about specifically in the context of STEM, there's quite a big group of people in STEM who majority probably identify as atheists, and so I'm sure you've probably encountered this viewpoint a lot, or maybe not, that there are quite a lot of people in STEM who seem to think that religion and science can't really coexist. And there's kind of this idea, at least in the West, where they're often painted as opposites, where like that you can't really mix the two together. So I just wondered, how do these relate to each other, in your opinion, as someone who identifies as both, obviously?
So I find that so interesting because, and I can only talk about Islam, right? Like, I don't really know about other religions. But in Islam, science is such a big thing. Like, the first university was founded by a Muslim woman. So I've never heard, and I've never had any of these conversations before. I would be dying to have this conversation with someone. I'm like, tell me it doesn't make sense I'm a Muslim and a scientist. Yeah. Let me tell you. The only reason you went to uni is because some Muslim woman, I don't know her name, but like in the 8th century, built a university. So, but a lot of Islam is actually rooted in science. Like, we have a lot of scientific literature. We have so many things in the Quran that has like science stuff about the universe. So I personally feel like you can be a scientist and be a Muslim, because it's in your faith, it's interwoven into the texts that we read, the hadiths, the sayings of our leaders. So no one could tell me that I can't be a scientist and be a Muslim. I would be like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think I mean, the example that was given to me before, so not in terms of Islam, but in terms of like evolution versus Adam and Eve, right? That's like the classic one. And I remember having a conversation with someone before, because I'm not atheist, I'm more agnostic, and I'm definitely very spiritualist. So in terms of ghosts and supernatural and heaven and stuff like that, I'm here for it. But I'm obviously a scientist as well, so a conversation stemmed from that. And basically they said, how can you be logical in terms of your science and evidence-based working, and then believe in things that can't be evidence, sort of thing. But basically the way that this other person described it was that you can believe in like a certain way that the universe began in terms of science. You can believe in the Big Bang, you can believe in evolution, but who started that? And then you can, that in that term, some higher being can actually still be involved in the same story. Like, they don't have to be like exclusive of one another. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but
no, I love it.
I get it.
And then what came before that?
Yeah.
I hear. That's very much GCSE me, when anyone had to ask me about like, how can you believe in this? And I was like, who made the Big Bang, bro?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Islam is rooted in science, and you know, we go by the Quran, right? So we follow the Quran and the teachings that are there, but we also follow, and obviously if someone's listening to this and they're Muslim and I'm wrong, please let me know. But like, in my mind, we also follow something called a hadith, which is like the teachings and the sayings of our prophet, which essentially is like our Bible, right? Because a hadith is stories, and they're people saying this is what the prophet has said. So we follow things like that. And in the Quran, for example, it doesn't explicitly say no to the theory of evolution. Obviously, it was written many years ago, but there's so much stuff about science and whatnot. Like, for example, like the Quran talks about like embryonic stuff, like when a baby is starting to be formed, like in such detail that it just wouldn't have made sense way back then. Islam and science go hand in hand. it's beautiful. And it's probably part of the reason why I'm so into science when I was growing up, because you'd see these little things and you connect the dots. So it's really cool.
So leading on from that, in your experience, is there anything that you wish people of other beliefs or no beliefs understood better about Islam, and, you know, in a way that would help them become better allies and more supportive colleagues?
That's an interesting one. I think maybe understanding that Islam doesn't oppose science, it might be a good thing. And that maybe if people, you know, consciously understood that, then maybe wouldn't be so surprised when we're here. Other than that, I think not assuming things about the faith. You know, we're intelligent people in academia. There's no sugarcoating that. So to not believe certain things that you might have seen on mainstream media, like this is something that's very well known, that mainstream media doesn't tell the full truth or doesn't actually understand faiths in general. So I unfortunately had an incident with a member of staff. It wasn't malicious, I'm sure, but comments were made about something that I was going through. Assumptions were made about Islam. Really just stay away from that. You know, if that was my number one piece of advice, don't assume something about someone's faith unless someone has expressed to you that this is something that's worrying them about their faith. Then fine, maybe talk to them about it. But unless that happens, I don't think it's appropriate to assume anything about someone else's faith, good or bad.
Yeah, it's about being informed as an ally, isn't it? And I think it's kind of ironic that we're talking about the research community, and often these people don't have the initiative to, or is that the right word? I don't know, to kind of go away and research the things that they're going to assume or that they're curious about, and then the burden is put on people to kind of like justify why they believe certain things or why they're doing certain things, rather than, you know, it's fine to be inquisitive, and it's fine to want to know more and learn more from each other. That's part of the fun of, you know, being social and being around people that are from different walks of life. But there's a respectful way to do that, in a way that you don't feel like you're entitled to the answers.
Questions are more than fine. I think more often than not, if you were to talk to a Muslim about whatever you wanted to talk to them about, but talking at them versus asking a question is very different. Like if this same person was asking a question, it would still be quite mad, but I would be like, okay, let me explain this to you. This is not the case. So it was very microaggression-y that time, that incident. And also, I've decided to do this in this particular way because this is what my faith has told me I need to do. And then to come and tell me, you should do it this way, which totally compromises my faith, is fully inappropriate.
It's like accidentally telling you my reasons for you doing this are more important than your reasons for not. So yeah, it is a respect thing. Yeah.
Some of the experiences you've just like spoken about, do you find it's specifically something that Muslim women have to deal with, where there's this like attitude from people outside the community that kind of assume you're being oppressed or not capable of making your own choices and decisions? Is that something that you think is fair to say Muslim women come up against quite a lot?
I can imagine that, but women have it in Islam, man. Like honestly, like when I get married, inshallah, one day, inshallah means God willing, I have the right for my husband to give me a set amount of money that I decide. That I decide. Obviously, it can be discussed. Obviously, I'm not going to tell my man. Yeah, like,
I'm sure it'll come up.
Like, at the end of the day, though, I could. Like, it's well, I'm well within my right to, there's like suggestions, but it's called a mahar, which is not a dowry. Because the dowry, I think, is to the man's family. This is to me. Yeah. It's not even to my family. This money goes to me. And he's not allowed to touch it. It's totally down to me. Obviously, culturally, we discuss things, and it's obviously appropriate in that sense. But the money is for me. If anything happens to him, then I need money to survive. And because I'm not obliged to have a job, if I wanted to, I can. But I'm not obliged to. I need money to just be. Right? Or God forbid anything happens and we have to get divorced and it's not my fault. That's
so interesting as well. That it's almost like the way it's like for you and so that you're not obliged to work, it almost like recognizes the sort of burden that women take on. Mm. Like if you get married and say have children, it's like you're actually, it's not unpaid labor, you're kind of recognized for that. That's so interesting.
Yeah,
we have to do so much. When research gets hard, I'm like, I really should have just been a housewife, but like, I would have had a great time. Yeah. I do love to cook, so
yeah.
But I also love research. But...
We've talked a little bit about some of your experiences, the good and the bad, in terms of people outside of the Muslim community. But we just wanted to touch upon also other people within that community. So specifically, do you find that there are any challenges for Muslim women in STEM from within the Muslim community?
From my experience, and I obviously can only talk about my experience right now, no. Like... more often than not, like, we just want to see each other win, you know, because in our faith we're all sisters, right? So it's just, it's comforting even to talk to your sisters about a thing, especially if they're within the same community. Like, I've never ever faced any sort of difficulty from another Muslim woman STEM about like what I'm doing. If there was ever an issue and the commonality was Islam, it would be more like a familial thing, and like that's more of a cultural issue as opposed to a Muslim issue. I'm very fortunate, like, especially in the university I'm at now, the Goldsmiths ISOC, 20 out of 10, love them, love those gals. They're so lovely, and like, just, yeah, Muslim sisters can be so welcoming. Like, I'm sure that people who don't have that same experience, but I can say that.
It's interesting that you talk about Muslim women sort of like lifting each other up and supporting each other. And then in terms of academia in general, it's kind of like we're built to be competitive, not collaborative, especially with like women and other underrepresented groups in STEM. It tends to be that there are not enough spaces at the top, right? And you know it. And so that's where imposter syndrome comes from. That's where comparing yourself constantly to your peers comes from. And it's the fact that we're bred to be competitive because we know that only the best get, you know, those slots, or only the most successful, or whatever. So you push yourself and you push yourself, and that's where it kind of breeds this perfectionism and things like that. So I'm just interested to know how those two things work together. So like, if you're in the environment of academia where you're being pushed to be better than your peers, how does that maybe is like counterbalanced by the fact that you're support in this supportive community?
It's either you see it as there's only one seat at the table, and if I don't get it, no one gets it. Or it's there's only one seat at the table, but if one of my sisters get it, it's like we all succeeded in that sense. And I think if you're a Muslim woman, and even as women in general, and you see it in the first way, it's an unfortunate mindset to have, because that's exactly what the people want. Like,
yeah,
they want
to say, that's what they want us to think. They want us to think, oh, right? There's only room for one of us. And
yeah.
But there's not. So it's a process. Like, if one of us is there, at least there's one of us there. And if we are working as a collective, if we don't isolate each other like that, then of course there's going to be more tables. Whereas if we do move in this sort of, it's me or it's you, then obviously we're going to continue having these minimal seats because we want to be the token woman there. We don't want another woman there because it has to be my seat. That's so wrong.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why maybe I haven't seen that, I don't have many Muslim women friends in STEM, but the ones that I do, the reason we don't have that, I think, is because although we all have varying understandings of our faith, the one thing that we do have is the sense of the ummah, like the community, the family that we are. Like, it's one ummah, it's one like group of humans. We're all sisters in this sense. And as a minority in that way as well, it doesn't serve us to be competitive with each other. And I hope anyway that I project that vibe, that sense of me being where I am means you can be where I am. It means I will help you in whatever capacity I have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I don't have that experience per se, because I'm very fortunate in that sense. Like the Muslims that I do know in STEM, we're very much together in that sense. It's collectively.
I feel like we need more of that.
Yeah. STEM women supporting women.
I guess just to sum up everything we've talked about, there's like two real questions that we want to just ask you. So firstly, what's one thing that you've learned so far in your journey through STEM that you'd share as advice, particularly for any Muslim women in STEM who are listening? And then the second one is, I guess, one thing you'd like to see allies doing more of to support Muslim women in STEM, to kind of sum up.
I think for the Muslim women specifically, I would say a couple of things. One is obviously to really rely on Allah when you can, because a PhD journey, an academic journey, is so tough. And sometimes it can feel hard to like go to people, and even maybe you're in the space where it does feel competitive, even with your sisters, that you go to Allah, because that's the first person who's going to understand. And at least you can like talk to someone unfiltered, do you know what I mean? And it's a free therapist. Secondly, is to try and find a community of Muslim women, because even if you're not talking to them about your work, they're going to uplift you. They're going to be like, wow, it's so amazing. Because whatever you're doing is probably really amazing, like 100%. And I think number three, and this is, I don't want it to sound preachy, but if you're a Muslim in STEM, specifically in academia, like STEM academia life, if you're a Muslim in academia and in STEM, then try to not let go of your prayer. I think it's hard as Muslims, especially maybe in our generation, where we grew up in this Western world, that sometimes prayer can take a back seat, but really utilize that time that's designated for us to connect with our creator. And that even links to number one, that you get to talk to your creator in that sense, like really utilize that time. And in an organizational way, use it to break up your day, you know? Like you need to wake up early for Fajr, fine, cool. It's hard in the summer, but try your hardest to start your day from there. And then organize your time around that. Leave the office before it gets to Maghrib, like the evening prayer.
So yeah, no, that was amazing. And I'm sure really helpful advice for anyone listening. So what's one thing you'd like to see allies doing more of to support Muslim women in STEM, if you had to pick one thing?
I would say be curious. Like, you can't help us as much if you have zero knowledge. I'm not saying you have to be an expert, but if you have zero knowledge, then how are you going to be able to spot things that are maybe inappropriate, or, you know, consider things that, or maybe is a bit uncomfortable? So like, for example, when I said I don't really like going to pubs at the moment and to socialize, but I can do it, there'll be others who can't. Like, you're going to, you know, if you want to be an ally, then you need to be finding out whether your Muslim cohort do feel comfortable. Become educated, watch videos. There is a collective called the Yaqeen Institute that do cute little infographics and quite simple videos on Islam that are very easy to understand if you want to know anything about Islam. For example, there's definitely one on the abortion situation, that's the Roe versus Wade thing. There's such a misconception about what Islam believes in terms of abortions. Yeah, I mean, it's mainly that, really. Just be curious and ask questions, it's fine, but don't be a dick about it.
I think that's what a lot of things come down to, really, isn't it?
I love that as a summary. Yeah, well said.
That's it. You just don't have to be a prick.
I fully support that.
know when our celebrations are. That's nice, I think. So in my office, I know quite like a handful of people there. There's maybe one person who I've connected with, and she's new to me, and I came in the office one day and she put a post-it up, and it had Ramadan Mubarak on it. And I couldn't tell you how warming that was.
Oh, so nice.
And it's so small. Like, it's literally this tiny little post-it, Ramadan Mubarak. It was so cute. Like,
that's nice.
Those small, small things make me feel so welcome and so safe in this environment. So yeah, just know our holidays, man. There's two.
Yes. Yeah,
there's two holidays a month. It's not, it's Google. You really just got to Google it. Don't ask in Ramadan. Sidebar, Don't ask anyone if we can drink water. Or don't be like, not even water. Just Google it.
No, solid, solid advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. Thanks for sharing all of that with our audience. Really great stuff to end on. While we're on the topic of sharing stuff with our audience, we always give everyone an opportunity at the end of an episode to share anything, literally anything, that you want to signpost our audience to, whether it's just something you're really excited about that you want people to go and check out, whether it's like something people can learn from, if it's just something that you think would be interesting for our audience, or if it's literally something you're involved in yourself, like a project or an initiative or anything that you want a bit more people power for as well, now is the opportunity to share it, and we'll make sure to put it in the show notes so that everyone can go and check it out.
Okay, well, I also have a science communication platform called PhD Pending. If you look it up, you'll probably find it. There's an underscore at the beginning. Yeah, follow me on there if you want to know more about what it's like to do a PhD as me. So as a Muslim, self-funded, it's very lighthearted. But again, I'm really open to anyone just messaging and sort of asking for advice, or, you know, maybe even sharing their experiences. Like, you just want to talk about something, like, I'm totally open for that. Please do that. But don't be upset if I don't reply super duper fast. Also, Yakin Institute was the website that I mentioned earlier. It's really, really cute. They do, like, it's obviously a platform for Muslims to like learn about their faith, but it's in such an easy formatting that you can learn about it too. Mm-hmm. Jody, since you're like a spiritual, they have like a whole series about angels, which is really beautiful.
Wow, okay,
so cute, made me cry. Like, obviously there's an Islamic context to it, and there's like, you know, bits and bobs from like hadiths and stuff, but in general it's just really nice to talk about the angels that are around you. So definitely worth checking out. And thirdly, if anyone's been watching the news recently, there have been really bad floods in Bangladesh, which is where I'm from. So if anyone has any money spare, or just a social media platform to share the news on that, there is a really amazing international organization called Restless Beings that are supporting Bangladesh, and it's Sylhet specifically, which again is where I'm from, so it's very close to home for me. And the floods are awful, and there's like just devastated homes, obviously people have passed away, and they really need the money to help either like feed themselves and rebuild their homes. Like, it's really, really, really awful. So yeah, check out Restless Beings. They'll have a link there on their pages. If you Google them, if you go on their Instagram, their Twitters, they have updates on what they're doing and links to help support the people down there.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds great as well. And I mean, we've talked about how we're super broke as PhD students, but even if it means you just go without a coffee, it's one coffee, you can, like, that money's really needed. So if you can, it sounds like a really important cause.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Mal.
Thank you for having me. Just ramble.
It's been great talking to you, and we really appreciate it. We know how busy you are, but yeah, I feel like it's just, we could chat so much longer, like stuff that's not even going to go into the podcast. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. I think it's really nice to talk about Islam along with my research as well. I feel like I'm either a Muslim or I'm a PhD student. I don't really get to talk about both in the same space. So
yeah,
thank you.
So if you enjoyed listening to that episode, and you want to find out more about Mal, you can find her on social media. She is on Twitter. We've put it in the show notes, so check that out. And also at underscore PhD pending on Instagram. So she's also a science communicator there. And I think we've also put a link to her Linktree in the show notes as well.
And then, so there's a couple of things that Mal mentioned throughout the episode. So there's the Yakin Institute, which you can check out. We'll leave the link in the show notes as well. It's a really nice platform to start out sort of learning about Islam and being a more informed ally, as Mal mentioned in the episode. Obviously there's a lot more to it, and definitely check out other sources as well if you're interested. But yeah, it's a nice starting place that Mal suggested.
And I know we started off this episode talking about how difficult it is to finance yourself as a PhD student. But if you do have any extra cash and are able to donate, there's also a link to Restless Beings, which is a cause really close to Mal's heart. So if you can check that out as well. And even if you don't have the money to donate right now, which we could like completely understand, even if you could share that on your various platforms, we'd be really grateful.
As usual, you know where to find us by now, I'm sure. We are at The Academinist on Instagram and Twitter, and you can email us at theacademinist@gmail.com. So yeah, we always love to hear from you and your feedback on the episode, so do share your thoughts with us.
And don't forget, if you are fed up with being on that side of the table and instead of listening to us, you want to talk to us, you can also find our Google form in our bio, on our social media and on our website. So come and have a chat.
So yeah, I think that's about it from us.
So when this is released, I'll be in San Diego. I'm going on
So now we've finished, we're going to pack Jodie off to to the US. Yeah, that's it. Off you go.
Not just for fun, despite the fact that my supervisor kept calling it a holiday and I had to send him the itinerary to kind of say, one, I'm away on my business trip / conference. So I'm going to be listening to the episode when it's released from California. So that's going to be cool. And then hopefully be back next month with another guest.
Yeah. So yeah, on that note,
bye. But no, it's been really great. My brain isn't working. It's almost 8 o'clock and I'm in the lab and it's very cold.